When I start to write a poem, I'll see a certain kind of color or tint or grit. And if I see that, if I see a certain mood in a poem, then I'm immediately thinking, okay, how do I subvert that particular mood and add to this poem its complete opposite? And so in all of my poems, there's always a mood, a mode, a color, a tint that changes. Line to line, I'm trying to do the opposite thing of what I just did in the line before.
That's poet, 2011 NEA Literature Fellow, and 2020 Pulitzer Prize winner, Jericho Brown. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Drawing on biography, history, mythology, the pastoral, Jericho Brown's Pulitzer Prize-winning collection, The Tradition, bears witness to tenderness, violence, love, anger, and vulnerability. It challenges and forces a reckoning with tradition, even as it seeks to enlarge its possibilities. And it does so with language that's both dazzling and haunting. Brown's work has been long acclaimed for its interrogation of race, masculinity, and queer love. And it's been equally acclaimed for its inventive celebration of language. His first collection, Please, takes the form of a tour through the canon of R&B, while his second book, The New Testament, is in conversation with the books of the Bible. Violence and tenderness are never far apart in Brown's work. In language that sings with lyrical intensity, Brown demands attention to the beauty of and damage done to the bodies of Black and queer people. There's an urgency in his poetry as he questions how and why we've become accustomed to brutality in all aspects of our lives, from our homes to the streets to the culture. The poem that opens and opens up the tradition like a key is called Ganymede, and that's where Jericho Brown and I began.
Ganymede. A man trades his son for horses. That's the version I prefer. I like the safety of it. No one at fault. Everyone rewarded. God gets the boy. The boy becomes immortal. His father rides until grief sounds as good as the gallop of an animal born to carry those who patrol our inherited kingdom. When we look at myth this way, nobody bothers saying, rape. I mean, don't you want God to want you? Don't you dream of someone with wings taking you up? And when the master comes for our children, he smells like the men who own stables in heaven, that far terrain between promise and apology. No one has to convince us. The people of my country believe we can't be hurt if we can be bought.
Ganymede, the first poem in your book, The Tradition. As I said, I think it just leads into this book so wonderfully. And do you want to walk us through what you were setting up with that poem for the rest of the book?
Well, I did want to start in myth and mythology. I think doing that gives an idea of how one of the many ways that the title is going to work in the book. How far back can we go? When do traditions begin? What traditions are ours? What traditions have been handed to us? What traditions do we have faith in that maybe have not been of use to us? There's a lot of rape in Greek myth. And so part of what I'm questioning in this book is rape culture and how rape culture is normal culture in this world and in this nation. And so I wanted to start the book with a subject who is known for having been raped. I'm always fascinated by the fact that one mark of a good education is that you get the Greek myths early, which means when you're 8 years old, you're opening page after page that are titled The Rape of Blank. And you're given these things as if they are regular, as if they're normal. And nobody ever takes you to the side to tell you that rape is not a good idea when you're reading these myths. And you also have the idea that it's okay for gods to rape men, to rape mortals.
I love that line. Don't you want God to want you?
Yeah.
And fill in the blank for God.
Yeah.
you mix classic myth and American history and your own experiences. It's all coming together in this book. And Ganymede ends with a statement pretty far removed from Olympus. The people of my country believe we can't be hurt if we can be bought.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that seems to be the people of Ganymede's country too, right? Ganymede's father is under that impression, and maybe Ganymede is too, in this poem at least. That's another thing I think that this book brings up is family, and what are the boundaries and the limits of family? How far can family go? Where is it possible for family to betray you, or betray you and not even know that they're betraying you, or for you to betray family? So I think that's a part of it. I also think this poem has interest in the natural world in the same way the book does. This is very much a pastoral book. So, you know, there's the pastoral moments of this poem. There's the appearance of the father. There's obviously a conversation in this poem about policing, ultimately, and about the economy, about capitalism. And so, you know, I think all of the things that I end up getting at in the book through various poems, I managed to get at all of them in this one poem. So that's why I chose it.
And I agree. That's why I asked you to open with it. You've said your poems make use of your life experience as a Black queer man from the South who has all kinds of other identities. You were raised in the church. You're a son. You're a son to your mother. You were a son to your father. You're a poet. You're a teacher. You're a homeowner. I mean, there's a host of complexities that make up who you are. And you complicated that still further by seeing how history seeps in through the generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. One of the things that I mean when I say the tradition is not just what we're looking at, but who was looking at it before us? How did it become what it was? How did it get passed down? The land is in my blood. Taking care of the land is in my blood. My grandparents on both sides of my family were sharecroppers, which is to say they were farmers. My father made a living through cutting people's yards and doing landscaping and cleaning flower beds. And so those are the kinds of things that have always been a part of my life. And I grew up with a mom and dad who really cared about what their neighborhood looked like and what their front and backyard looked like, not just for themselves, but as a contribution to the community. And it's always interesting to me that that might not be something that people think of when they think of Black people. And yet that's who we are. That's what we do. So that's part of why this book got written.
Well, you have a poem in the tradition that actually speaks to that called 4 Day in the Morning. And I think it's one of my favorite poems in the book. Do you mind reading that one?
Yeah, I'll read it for you.
Thanks.
4 Day in the Morning. My mother grew morning glories that spilled onto the walkway toward her porch because she was a woman with land who showed as much by giving it color. She told me I could have whatever I worked for. That means she was an American. But she'd say it was because she believed in God. I am ashamed of America and confounded by God. I thank God for my citizenship in spite of the timer set on my life to write these words. I love my mother. I love Black women who plant flowers as sheepish as their sons. By the time the blooms unfurl themselves for a few hours of light, the women who tend them are already at work. Blue, I'll never know who started the lie that we are lazy. But I'd love to wake that bastard up at 4 a.m. in the morning, toss him in a truck, and drive him under God past every bus stop in America to see all those Black folk waiting to go work for whatever they want. A house? A boy to keep the lawn cut? Some color in the yard? My God, we leave things green.
That was 4 a.m. in the morning. 4 a.m. is a word I was not familiar with.
Yeah, it's a very Southern word, very South Louisiana, actually. And I'm from North Louisiana. When I did hear some older people use that term, but I heard it more commonly when I moved to New Orleans. And it's, as the poem makes clear, it's that time before morning. It is morning, but it's before the sun comes up, you know, and there are so many of us who are getting up and getting ready or getting to work at that time. and doing the work that other people don't see done. You know, many of us arrive at an office or arrive at a kitchen or arrive at a restaurant or something. Wherever we're going to, somebody's already been working there a few hours before we get there, setting it up for our entrance so we can get our work done. And that's part of what 4-Day in the Morning is about.
And it obviously is also exploding one of the myths of America, too. Or more than one, actually, when you go through the poem, quite a few.
Yeah, well, one of those myths has to do with being able to have whatever you work for. Another myth has to do with the stereotype of Black people being lazy, which is fascinating how that managed to get invented when Black people are the people who built this country as slaves, quite literally built the White House with their bare hands. It's not a stereotype that really adds up, right? And then maybe there are a few other traditions or myths that I'm questioning in this particular poem. I think when I wrote this poem, the thing that I was most proud of, to be honest with you, is that I got to say I love my mother in a poem. And I think it's very difficult to say something that might at first seem sentimental. There's a way that I'm proud to have managed to get it in here without it being as sentimental as one might expect.
I had read that this poem first appeared in Time magazine, and that's how your mom got to see it.
Yeah, I sent it to my mom. You know, I don't really send a lot of poems to her, but when a poem comes up in Time magazine, you know, it's like, oh, and it's about my mom, so it'll be good for her to see. Yeah, so it's gonna, you know, I don't really send my work to my parents. You know, when a book comes out, I don't even tell them about it. They did know that I won the Pulitzer. I did tell them about that. I was on the cover of the Shreveport Sun, which is the newspaper where I'm from. So they sort of had to find out anyway. But, you know, when it comes to work stuff, I understand that I need to keep a lot of it to myself in order to get it made, to get it done. And then sometimes when certain moments of recognition come up, I'll tell my parents, because I think the hardest thing for any artist, and particularly for poets, is translation. It's always hard to let people know, your friends, your family, your parents in particular. They're very confused about what you're doing. And so when good moments of recognition come up, like having a poem in Time magazine, when moments like that come up, it's really wonderful because you feel like you can translate. You feel like, oh, here's something to show that I actually have a job and a passion and something with value. So, you know, every once in a while, I will show them some of that stuff so they're not worried about me.
Well, this actually piggybacks on what you just said, because you've written about having HIV in your previous work. The New Testament, most particularly, To Be Seen, is one of the poems that looks at that. And in this book, you allude to it several times, including a poem told from the virus's point of view. But in the tradition, you write a poem, Layover, about your rape, and it's a rape that gave you HIV. Can you tell me how you got to the place where you would and could write about the rape?
Yeah, I have been actually, as you say, in the other books, I do maybe a bit more obliquely hint at HIV. And there are poems that are directly about HIV. If you have HIV, you know it. Or if you're aware of the fact that people have HIV, you know it. And then there are also poems that hint at rape or that talk about it a little more obliquely in my first book and in my second book, but definitely in my first book. There's a poem called Because My Name is Jericho, which is about that rape. But this book seemed to me, I think it was the first time I ever wrote poems because I felt convicted to do so. And when I say convicted, I mean it in the same way that we see it in the Bible, conviction, as in I felt it was my responsibility. I generally don't think feeling that something is your responsibility is a good place to begin to write poems. I think you should really just start with language and figure out what your responsibilities are as you go. But there was so much going on as it related to the Me Too movement while I was writing this book. And I felt that I was hearing a lot of women talk about sexual violence, sexual assault, rape, sexual coercion, sexual harassment. I was hearing that from women in a way that I was not hearing it from men. And I felt like that picture of things was actually quite dishonest. Many of the men I know, many of my close friends, they had their first sexual experiences when they were little boys, some of them high school boys, but often, very often, they had those first sexual experiences with grown men and women. And they would not call that rape. They call that their early sexual experiences. And yet if those same things were to happen to their kids, they would call it rape. Do you know what I mean? So it seemed like I had this obligation somehow to speak more directly to my own rape and to HIV because of what I was seeing around me, and because it didn't seem right or fair that women were the only people carrying the brunt of all of that truth that we hadn't faced about the way men can be in these situations, the way all of us can be, I imagine, in these situations where sexual violence occurs. And so that's what allowed me, or led to me, facing it more directly. It seemed like if other people could, then I should. And so when language would arrive for it, I would go in that direction. I had no idea that I was avoiding it, honestly. And I think writing the poems, I realized that I had been avoiding being more direct about that. It's not so easy, no matter how much therapy you have or how many meetings you go to. It's really actually not so easy to talk about rape when you're a man, to talk about having been raped. Even now, it sort of makes me nervous, but I also know it's got to be done. It's also wonderful to have something in the book, because then you can't run from it or hide from it anymore. And then HIV is also really difficult to discuss. I think people think that I'm 100% comfortable. In many ways, I'm obviously way more comfortable than I was when I first was diagnosed. At the same time, I know there's a lot of prejudice against people with HIV, even in the queer community. Many people think of folk with HIV as undesirable, and not just in the bedroom, undesirable in the world, you know, period. So I think those poems in particular got written because part of what I imagine will happen as I'm writing poems over this life of mine is I will face everything. And the books, the poems allow me to face them. If I can face them, I can love them, and I can accept myself more fully for who I am. And I can accept those things as a part of me. And if I can accept those things as a part of me, then I have something to be proud of. You know, I have this this thing I live with, or this thing I survived, or this thing I've overcome, or this thing that really didn't have to be overcome, that is just as gorgeous as I am somehow. So that's part of what I'm doing when I'm writing these poems. I'm creating a full integration of all my life experiences, but also not just my life experiences, all of my imaginations, all of the trivia I know, all of the science that I know, all of everything I have has to be at the access of my poems.
So many of the poems occupy a space where love and brutality, or tenderness and violence, are just banging up against each other throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see that very often. I think it's completely true in life, but you don't see that very often in poetry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how often you see it in poetry, but I do think it's true that it is completely true in life, and that's all I care about, right? Like, poems, I think, should be like trees. I want them to be useful in ways to us that we can't imagine unless they're gone. You know, our relationship to trees is such that we don't know what the trees are doing for us, but if they were gone, we would definitely miss them, you know? And I want my poems to be like living things. I want them to be like life, and I want them to exude the beauty of life. And I think life is not, it's not easy. It's complex. You know, there's a lot going on, and you are over and over again in any real life. You live a life where the violences live right next to the tendernesses. So that's part of what I'm trying to do in all of my poems. And I think maybe there are other poets that do that too. But I think I'm doing it over and over again, and I'm very conscious of trying to do it, because when I start to write a poem, I'll see a certain kind of color or tint or grit. And if I see that, if I see a certain mood in a poem, then I'm immediately thinking, okay, how do I subvert that particular mood and add to this poem its complete opposite? And so in all of my poems, there's always a mood, a mode, a color, a tint that changes line to line. I'm trying to do the opposite thing of what I just did in the line before. And so that's why those things get juxtaposed over and over again.
You said once that you like to begin poems with the sound of words and how they kind of brush up against each other, and then you play with that. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I was actually just talking about this in another interview recently, about how in the first couple of lines of the tradition, really the first line, you hear an er sound, that the poem, the tradition, the er, the ur sound, and how that sound gets repeated throughout the poem. Because once I make a sound in a poem, you're going to hear that sound again, not any more than four syllables later. Do you know what I mean? And so whatever sounds I'm making as I make a sentence, as I make a line, whatever sounds I'm making, part of how I know what comes in the next line isn't because I know what I have to say. It's because I know what sounds the next line has to make. If you know the sounds that you're looking for, then you can sort of fish around for words that make those particular sounds. Once you find the words that make those sounds, that tells you what you're saying. The words themselves will lead you to what you're saying more than you trying to find the words for what you have to say. I usually try to approach poems without anything to say. And I think it's better for me that way because then I can figure out what my real concerns are. I can figure out what I've really been thinking, and I can tap into my subconscious or unconscious mind.
Why is that important for you to do?
I think part of the reason why that's important for me, well, there are two reasons why that's important for me, Joe. Reason number one is I want to write poems that change me, and I can't do that if I'm not figuring out what I have to say as I say it, if I'm not doing an investigation through language that leads to discovery. And then once I make those discoveries, I can say, oh, is that what I think? And then I can start living like it. You know what I mean? Like I can change, literally change the way I live because I say things I don't expect to say in my poems. And I imagine that they must be closer to what I really believe. So there's a kind of truth in the poems. And then the second thing is, the repetition of sounds makes for a kind of oneness, a unified whole in the feeling of the poem. And so that kind of discovery through language investigation, that kind of thing can be made more into a piece of art, more into something that we feel like we hold because its sounds are unified.
Well, you invented a form called the duplex, which certainly has repetition in it. Can you explain what that form is?
Yeah, the duplex is it's an amalgamation of three forms, the sonnet, the huzzle, and the blues, which are three forms I identify with in many ways. And it is a form that allows me to marry East and West. You know, it's 9 to 11 syllables a line. So I'm thinking about syllabics, which is how many things are formed in Eastern poetics. And I'm thinking about the way that number of syllables can get married to meter, which is how we think about a form in Western poetics. And it also is a way of me really casting a spell, to be honest with you. I was thinking about how a repeated line is like a chant. And when you're chanting something, you're casting a spell. And poems themselves seem to me a lot like spells and prayer, right? And so I wanted to make a poem that you felt hypnotized by or entranced by in some way. And I thought the repetition of that line would be a part of that, knowing that whatever line you heard, you were going to hear at least once more. It was important to me to make a poem that was like a series of repeated lines. And what I think I really love about it is that it's a form that reminds me of me. It's hard to identify other than calling it a duplex. You sort of look at it like, are you a sonnet or are you a hover? What are you? What are you doing over there? So part of what I love about it is I feel like I'm a person who's always called to the mat about identity. And I don't really, you know, I don't really put myself into percentages. I don't think of myself as 66% black and 12% queer and 2% Southern. And, you know, I don't do that kind of math until I get to 100%. I just think I'm 100% everything that I am. So that's part of how the duplex came to be.
Do you mind reading one?
Yeah, I'll read you a duplex.
Will you read the one that's on page 18 of the tradition?
Okay. Duplex. A poem is a gesture toward home. It makes dark demands I call my own. Memory makes demands darker than my own. My last love drove a burgundy car. My first love drove a burgundy car. He was fast and awful, tall as my father. Steadfast and awful, my tall father hit hard as a hailstorm. He'd leave marks. Light rain hits easy. but leaves its own mark, like the sound of a mother weeping again. Like the sound of my mother weeping again, no sound beating ends where it began. None of the beaten end up how we began. A poem is a gesture toward home.
The repetition is so haunting, and that poem just draws me in. I literally found myself physically leaning into it. I heard you say when you were writing the tradition, the writing had been going slowly, and then between Thanksgiving and MLK Day, something happened, and it was like a geyser, and you wrote 40-some-odd poems. Will you walk me through that experience?
It wasn't slow in a bad way. It's always slow between books. You know, it's slow right now. And I had some poems, but not a lot of poems. I mean, maybe I had half the book done. You know what I mean? Maybe I had something like 15 to 20 to 25 poems or something, some of which were not very good. But I didn't care because I was just working on poems. And I imagined that if they turned into a book today, they just would. And then I just got hit by something. I think it wasn't really a bolt of inspiration. I think there were a lot of little inspirations that led up to what happened to me. You know, I was experiencing a lot of great art. I had been to the Biennale in Italy. Claudia Rankine's Citizen had come out. Barry Jenkins's Moonlight had come out. So there were many pieces of television, film, visual art, and poetry that I hadn't had before that I think were inspiring me in many ways. And when Thanksgiving came, you know, you have that little break from teaching or from going to school if you're in school or from anything. You know, Thanksgiving usually in the United States comes with a little bit of a break. So I did a little, what I thought was a little writing, and I just couldn't stop. The duplexes were mostly written in January and February of the next year. I mean, all of them were done in January and February of the next year, which would have been, it must have been 2017, 2018 is when all of this was going on. And then the book came out in 2019. But I wrote something between 30 and 40 pages of poetry in those weeks. And they were pretty good too. I was like, whoa, you're writing. So I would, you know, and I was writing in some instances, three poems in a day. And I would send them to my friends and they'd say, when you write this one? And I would say, today. And they're like, there's no way you wrote these poems today. They're done. You know, and I'm like, I know, it's crazy. It was scary to me though. It was really wonderful. I don't want to pretend I didn't love every minute of it, but it was exhausting. I was writing on elevators. I was pulling over my car to write poems in traffic. I was not really sleeping. I had a new job that included me having to be at work very often at 8 or 9 in the morning. And I would go home and I would write until 6 in the morning. So that's how much sleep I was getting. So it was a really hard time, but I didn't want to turn away from the poems and I didn't want to turn the poems away. So I was... So I had to take them as they would come, but I really was afraid that something bad was about to happen to me, Joe. I know it sounds weird, but I spent a lot of time in my life wondering what I was supposed to do. And then I figured out, oh, just do the thing you love to do. And that's write poems. And so because I've really only ever been sure that I could do one thing, the fact that I was doing it all at one time made me think I was going to die. I was certain that this wonderful gift that I had gotten from God was coming to its end and God was trying to milk me of my last vestiges of talent before taking me out of here. You know what I mean? So, but that wasn't the case. You know, the book came out and I'm still alive. So it's been a few years and I'm still alive. It's been a couple of years. I'm still alive now.
So. Oh my gosh. You came to poetry at a young age, you said. Your mom would drop you off at the library. When did reading become writing for you?
I don't know that it ever wasn't. As soon as I figured out what poems were and how they were working, the fact that they were shorter, I felt like I could do it. I wasn't so great at it, but it does give you the feeling that you could do it. Now, I understood, I think maybe the difference between me and other people or maybe other kids was I understood that my poems were not as good as Sylvia Plath's at the time. You know, I would read a poem by Plath and I would try to do something she had done, like break the modifier from the noun, like in a poem like Edge. You know, she says her bare line break feet. And I remember thinking, oh my God, wow, I've never seen anything like that. What has she done? And so, you know, I would write a poem that was like the white refrigerator, you know. so I was doing that kind of thing, which really didn't, you know, it didn't work in the same way as Plath's poems did. But I was, you know, practicing even then, and my mom would get excited and she would put it on a magnet on the refrigerator, you know. So I had a little bit of support too. So I just kept trying, you know. So I don't know that it ever wasn't. I think when I found poetry, I found what writing would look like for me.
You once said growing up in the Black church prepared you for life as a poet. And I'm so curious about that.
Yeah. I mean, well, for one thing, I just think what happens in the church is a lot like a poem itself. It has its form, but you don't know what's going to happen. The order of service is the same every Sunday, but you don't know when the shouting's going to happen. You don't know who's going to do the shouting, or you don't know what that's going to look like. You don't know what the pastor is going to say. You don't know what song the choirs are going to sing unless you went to choir rehearsal and you're in the choir. So those kinds of things are how that surprise, but that surprise that's also within a formal constraint reminds me of poems themselves. But also, I think I learned in church how to be in community and how to deal with a community that has a common interest. And I feel like that has a lot to do with relationships that poets have to one another today and historically. And I think I also learned what it felt like to be in front of an audience and to testify, to witness, to give the goods over, to tell all your business, you know, to put yourself on the line, knowing that that audience, that community would gain something from your witnessing or from your testimony and somehow become closer to you because of your witness and your testimony. So that I learned that in church. And I think I actually also learned about travel, to be quite honest with you. I went to a church where I did sing in the youth choir, and we were always following our pastor around from church to church when he would get asked to do other things. He was a very high up official in the National Baptist Convention organization. And he had been a wonderful civil rights leader. His name was the Reverend Harry Blake. And he died recently of COVID in 2020. Which was very hard for me because I think of him as sort of like a second dad or something. He was a huge mentor to all of us and a wonderful, just a wonderful human being.
I'm sorry. That's very, very difficult.
But you know, he was really a good pastor, which has to do with more than preaching, but he was a good preacher. You know, we were captivated. And I think something about the way he would read passages from the Bible and then go about explicating them. There was something about that taught me what poems should sound like. And I'm grateful for that experience.
Well, I'd like to hear what another poem of yours sounds like, and that's the title poem, The Tradition.
Yeah, sure. I mentioned it earlier, so it's good for me to read it now. The Tradition. Aster nasturtium delphinium. We thought fingers in dirt meant it was our dirt, learning names in heat, in elements classical philosophers said could change us. Stargazer, foxglove. Summer seemed to bloom against the will of the sun, which news reports claimed flamed hotter on this planet than when our dead fathers wiped sweat from their necks. Cosmos, baby's breath. Men like me and my brothers filmed what we planted for proof we existed before too late. Sped the video to see blossoms brought in seconds. Colors you expect in poems where the world ends. Everything cut down. John Crawford, Eric Garner, Mike Brown.
That chilling couplet at the end and the way you... We return to dead Black men throughout this collection. Mm-hmm. And so it's very much of the moment, but it's also so rooted in such a deep history. The poems, as you say, they testify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think it was really important that the names of these Black men who had been murdered by police, but also other Black people who appeared throughout this book. You know, there's a little James Baldwin in this book, some S.X. Hemphill in this book. In one way or another, they were either murdered by some state-sanctioned way, murdered by our nation and our state, or they were neglected in a way that led to death, so murdered indirectly. you know, this pandemic that we are going through now, this is not our first pandemic. And it's the first one that we rushed to have vaccines for, because the one we experienced before seemed to only affect gay men. And because it seemed to only affect gay men, people thought it was perfectly fine for them to be dead. It's not a spirit of trying to go after anybody. I want to commemorate the people who were here and who allowed for me to be here. I want to commemorate the people who made it so that I could be a poet, so that I could have this conversation with you, so that you would want to have this conversation with me. There was a time that I would not have been a candidate to even come on this show, and it wouldn't have anything to do with my poems. It would just have to do with the fact that I was a Black gay poet from the South. You know what I'm saying? So those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in, and that's why those names appear in that poem. That poem is for them. It's not for me. I imagine that something could come of having written a poem for them and not for me.
It can't be an accident that the following poem on the facing page is called Hero.
Oh, no, not at all. As a matter of fact, whenever I'm organizing a book, I try to organize it such that the last line leads to the title of the next poem. And so you, through reading the book, you not only learn what you learn from that poem, but you learn something by reading the next poem. Reading the next poem will tell you more about the poem that you just read, is my hope. That's one of the ways that I hope when people read a Jericho Brown book, they just keep turning the page, because they're learning, they're finding out more than they expected to find out. Yeah.
Winning the Pulitzer the same year as Michael R. Jackson won for Drama, a Black queer writer steeped in the church.
Yeah, he's
great. And he makes that central to his work. I mean, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, yeah. Michael's really wonderful. We talk on the phone here and there, and he's always got great ideas. He's so smart, and he tells the truth all the time. And I love being around somebody like that.
It's been a year, pretty much, since you've won the Pulitzer. And I wonder, have you begun to process what winning meant for you, especially for this book, especially at this time?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure in terms of meaning. I mean, I do know what it means for my emails. I know what it's meant for my workload. Gratefully, I know what it's meant for me financially. But on a larger and probably more important scale beyond Jericho Brown, I'm not really sure. I think something about the winning the Pulitzer Prize probably is what led to it being chosen as for the One Book Philadelphia Community Read, which was a big deal for me. It still is. It's something I'm very proud of. They hadn't done a book of poetry before, so I was the ambassador for poetry, which made me feel very responsible. So yeah, you know, those kinds of things. I think having conversations like this with people, I wrote an article about Pride last year for the New York Times. There are many opportunities, I think, that have come my way that otherwise may not have come my way if I hadn't won the Pulitzer. There are probably many opportunities open to me that would not be open to me if I hadn't won the Pulitzer. But I don't know. I mean, I know what that means for me. I don't know what that means for people or what that means for literature. I can hope, I can imagine, but we have to see, you know, we got to see 5, 10, 50 years down the line, what the tradition has done to folk, what it's done to poetry. The Pulitzer Prize is like this great promotional tool almost, right? What that does and how that changes things. What I hope, one of the things, I mean, there are probably 6 billion things I hope knowing me, but there's one thing, you know, Michael and I are the first Black queer people to win in our categories. And yet I hope that one of the things that it's done is created a world where we won't be the last. You know what I mean? When certain doors are open, you find that if the door is opened, everybody ought to be able to walk through. So I'm looking forward to what we think of a writer. I'm looking forward to our idea of that changing in terms of how we see the identity of that person. And you remember this, Joe, when I was a kid, when I thought of a writer, I was a Black kid surrounded by Black people who had pens and paper. But when I thought of a writer, I thought of an old man who was white and had a white beard. And I want that not to be what people have to think. I want people to be able to think of all kinds of faces, all kinds of backgrounds when they think of writers. And I think maybe something about winning the Pulitzer could change people's idea, continue to change. Obviously, that idea has already started shifting, but continue to change people's idea of that. I think
one of the wonderful things about me being a queer writer is,
quite honestly, the fact that I write about me being a queer writer means that I have a different kind of subject matter that I'm often approaching. We're all going to be right. Everybody's writing about desire. Everybody's writing love poetry. And yet not all of the love poetry is queer poetry. Maybe that will change too. People's idea and people's idea of what love can look like could also change.
I'd like to end with a poem, if you don't mind. And I really would like to end with the duplex, the one on page 49.
Yeah, sure. I'll read that duplex for you. Duplex. I begin with love, hoping to end there. I don't want to leave a messy corpse. I don't want to leave a messy corpse full of medicines that turn in the sun. Some of my medicines turn in the sun. Some of us don't need hell to be good. Those who need most need hell to be good. What are the symptoms of your sickness? Here is one symptom of my sickness. Men who love me are men who miss me. Men who leave me are men who miss me in the dream where I am an island. In the dream where I am an island, I grow green with hope. I'd like to end there.
Thank you so much, Jericho. I really appreciate you giving me your time, being so generous reading, and we should all grow green with hope.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Jill. Thank you.
You're welcome. That was poet and 2011 NEA Literature Fellow, Jericho Brown. We were talking about his 2020 Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of poetry, The Tradition. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.